Okay, welcome back, everyone. We now have another presentation on management accounting principles. This is from Temu Malmi, who's going to give us an academic view. We've just heard earlier on that you can actually trust an academic. Temu is a totally trustworthy, I think. So he's going to speak for about 35, 40 minutes. We'll have, I think, a bit of time for question and answers, and then I'll talk about the breakout sessions and how that's going to work. So all yours, Temu.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, and thanks for kind invitation to give this sort of view on management accounting principles. What I'm going to do now is I'll provide a very brief professional and institutional background. So who am I, where I come from, you should have my CV, so I'm going to spend about a minute for that. Then I will review the stated needs for these principles. I've been sort of reading the document, and I'm trying to understand why these principles are needed. So a short summary about those, because if I try to somehow evaluate those, I guess it should be done against the purpose or need for those. Then I present my analysis of the principles and their application based on my reading of this work. And then some discussion, again, some of these questions and ideas were floated by Mike and so forth. But again, we'll discuss a little bit about the principles versus standards, or whether this should be voluntary or forced, or what is the link to the research. And then again, as there was a question, I tried to answer it as well. So I will provide my own view whether we need these. My background, I've done management accounting research about 25 years. I've done interventionist research as well, trying to contribute to practical problem solving. We wrote together with Markus Granlund a paper some time ago. It was published in the European Accounting Review. It was titled Insurance of Management Accounting Theory, where we tried to argue that the theories we produce here should be somehow relevant for practice. I've done a lot of consultancy during the 25 years and a lot of executive training, including CFOs, controllers, and so forth. And also running a department at our university. And in Finland, basically, the universities have a very crucial role in accountants' education. So we don't have similar professional bodies in like SIMA here. University education in Stockholm is about 5 years on a row. And basically, we think that the students require relatively little additional training once they graduate. Of course, there's a lot of learning during their careers, but we don't have kind of a similar type of setup like you have here in the UK. All right, that's my background. Let me review quickly the need for principles. What we read from here is that there's a global competition, increasingly interconnected markets, and technological progress and so forth. I basically agree with all of this. I mean, I think the issue identification is well done. The decision-making today is more and more complex. I guess my question is, are these type of principles a solution for that complexity? And that's something I think we should be discussing today. And the other issue I'm having with this kind of a issue identification is that could it be actually extended? What I'm having in my mind is that when I read these principles, it's very heavily oriented towards decision-making. And for me, management accounting is management accounting supporting decision-making and control. And on the control side, again, I'm not quite sure if the world has become more simple to control multinational global organizations. And I certainly believe that the management accountants could have a large and important role in controlling organizations. So again, if we extend the issue identification a bit beyond the decision-making only, then it might have some implications on these principles, I guess. If you read the first two ones, there is this chartered global management accounting designation. And if we do a designation, that perhaps requires some kind of a criteria to identify those talented and committed individuals. I understand that we would like to do something like this, and I understand that if we have this kind of a designation, that requires some kind of criteria. Of course, now we have to ask ourselves, do these criteria, as they stand, help us to give that kind of a designation. Then there's this question of providing guide to management accounting practice or best practice, or to support benchmarking and help us to improve management accounting systems. Again, we can ask and try to assess whether the principles as they stand do help us to benchmark and develop our practices. And then there are a number of other sort of statements what they are supposed to do. And finally, there are quite many accounts on what else we are hoping for from these principles. They should outline the fundamental values and qualities that represent management accounting. They should improve our understanding of the profession and increase the recognition and so forth. So quite a lot, actually, what we might sort of expect from these principles, I guess. You know who this guy is? Yes, Frank Zappa. Do you know why he is here? Yeah, he recorded an album in 1975, I guess. It was titled One Size Fits All. My worry as an academic, of course, is this. Is there a room for universal best practice? In the 1960s, I guess the accountancy research was pretty much normative in nature, providing some kind of an advice on how to do things. Again, I'm sure that this kind of a advice could be given to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, we moved on and we were presented by and we were immersed by contingency theory, whether we want to call it a theory or not, but I think the underlying idea that there is no one-size-fits-all should be evident for all academic accountants and accountant researchers, at least. My own hobby for the last couple of years has been this question of whether these external contingencies actually explain how we should apply our accounting practices, or should we also look, in addition to external contingencies, on other tools and controls management have in their disposal to get people to do what they want them to do. And again, for me at least, the accounting is always a part of the control package or control system in large, and then again we have to understand what other systems these executives use. And finally, research shows and the common sense tells us that when the firms grow and mature, the accounting evolves. And again, begs the question of does the one size fits all? So based on this, I mean, my question, I guess, is that when we try to produce universal principles, the threat is that they are so universal that they provide little guidance beyond self-evident, unfortunately. I'm not saying that I'm not saying that they are useful or they are not used, but that I guess one of my main messages today is that if we want to develop something like principles or standards or whatever, the question is what kind of principles or practices would really be useful. We might have a look on those as well. Let me move on. I'll next comment on these principles shortly, and then I comment on the application of those principles. The objective, to drive better decisions about strategy and its execution at all levels. Again, that's what the document says. And it's then divided in three sort of sub-sections. Strategy and development and execution is a conversation, communication is tailored, and communicate facilitates better decisions. Again, reading this, again, for me, seems somewhat, as I would say, self-evident. In page 9, the focus is on strategy execution, not that much of strategy development. But what I was sort of observing and reading with an interest was this sort of question of top-line objectives should be somehow linked to individual targets. Again, not a new idea, not something that sort of surprised me at all, but at least in my consulting and executive training practice, this is always a question. How do we do this linkage properly, and could we actually provide some kind of a guidance on that? Communication is tailored. Again, this seems to be self-evident in theory, and it's easy to say, but it doesn't seem to be a common norm in practice that we are tailoring our sort of communication well. And again, in this, it brings me back to the question of how management accounting profession or accountants are resources within the large organizations. If you have a lot of resources, you can tailor-made things, but if you are very lean and operating in scarce resources, then a question of how much you can do this tailoring comes to a question. And again, are there universal rules on how to do it? I'm not quite sure. And again, communication facilitates the decisions. So for me, it sounds like a jargon, but and it mainly repeats the previous point. But again, if I look these reading of how this communication works, it seems that it works from us, management accountants, being able to communicate to those who use our information. And then when I read the next principle, information is relevant, it says that principle ensuring management accountant knows the decision at hand and the needs of the decision maker. So when I'm reading the first principle and the second principle and the justification at the second principle, it doesn't really match with what the first principle is doing. So again, I understand this is a work in progress and this will be developed. So if you hear some criticism in my words, don't take it as a sort of as an opposition, but like a constructive way of improving this. Information is relevant. I guess it goes back to Rick's question of who would provide and produce irrelevant information. I fully agree that we have a lot of irrelevant reporting in many organizations. So again, perhaps this is a useful reminder. But again, for me, reading this principle and reading these pages, I'm not quite sure how it helps me to improve and create better and more relevant information. Perhaps, again, the reminder that incomplete and unfair data should be flagged is something that accountants don't normally do so well on average. I like this one a little bit better than the previous one. I think this principle says something beyond obvious, especially when I was listening to Naomi's presentation about what we mean by value. So again, we outline here that the accountants should be simulating different scenarios that demonstrate the cause and effect relationship between inputs and outcomes. And again, not much new in a sense, but again, how much we actually do this on a day-to-day basis is another question. If you read that, I'm not quite sure how scenario models help to quantify the likelihood of an opportunity to succeed or risk occurring. I understand that if we dig and we put up a process that sort of helps us to analyze the situation and different scenarios, and we involve different practitioners, different informants from different areas, that might sort of improve our ability to somehow judge the probabilities. But just by running the models and simulations, you always have to set up some kind of an estimation of your probabilities, and a simulation as such won't really help you to get the better estimates of probabilities. But once you set up a probability in there, then of course it will provide you some kind of a values and so forth. Actions are prioritized by the impacts on outcomes. Yes. Again, this sounds like too obvious to me. I invested in one biotech company some time ago. I was talking to this guy, he was a head scientist of the company. He used to be, by the way, the guy who was responsible of R&D, of a pharmaceutical arm of Roche, Jonathan Knowles, a very nice gentleman. But he said that during his time in Roche, whenever someone came with some figures showing that this new pharmaceutical will be this and this profitable or not, he said that the only thing he knew, that the numbers were rubbish. He never knew how much there was rubbish on up or down. So basically, he was perfectly sure that the numbers are rubbish. So again, it's very easy to say that we build up on value and we try to assess what's valuable, what's not. But in practice, we have a lot of difficulties in really producing meaningful analysis in very many situations in today's complex world. Okay, stewardship builds trust. Again, this applies to the individual's behaviors, and again, if I read those, accountability and credibility, sustainability, and integrity and ethics, much of this is really covered in professional code of conduct already, as well as the code of conduct of large corporations that I've been working with. What was sort of interesting and noteworthy to me, at least, was this very strong emphasis on sustainability. And perhaps that's a well-justified comment and argument in today's world. Of course, I find these useful reminders all the time, but then again, like some of the audience were asking about the novelty of these sort of principles and ideas. Perhaps I had a little bit same worry that I'm reading, and everything that I read makes perfect sense. But what is it that I learn by reading this? Now, if we look at how these principles are then suggested to be applied, first of all, they were supposed to be applied to people, then to performance management, and then to practices. So I will address shortly people, then performance management, and then those practices. We have this competency framework where we discuss about technical, business, people, and leadership skills. Having been sort of planning and developing various kind of professional training programs, I take this one very seriously. But then the question is, how does this framework, as it stands, helps me to kind of develop different levels of academic or professional education? Again, the framework is far too broad to me to be useful. And I wrote here that criteria as well as the methods for evaluation for proficiency levels would be interesting to read. To be a little bit more constructive, it would be very nice to be involved in actually creating those. I think academics, we could help to create some kind of a criteria, we could make a judgment. We have quite long experience of building courses in our bachelor's, master's program, and executive programs in for various levels of competences. So again, I think we should move beyond the very broad framework to sort of start to talk about what is it that actually are required for level 1, level 2, level 3, or level 4. Performance management. Strategize, plan, execute, or plan, do, check, act, or... Yep, I fully agree again here that the management accountant should be involved. What was interesting to me was a very, very strong emphasis on data planning. And again, when I think about what is performance management and how I perceive it, I would say that it's both decision-making and control. You have to be able to make decisions, but you also have to be able to make other ones within your organization to make and take those decisions. So we get back to this issue, a question of why there is so little emphasis on management control side of the story. There are some hints, there are some notions there and here and there, but it's mainly driven by this decision making. And then the practices. I have exactly the same question as Rika and Jeremy Dent had here earlier. Is all accounting part of the management accounting? Is all what we do in an organization part of the management accounting, really? Financial accounting, transaction processing, recording and basic reporting, external reporting, treasury. Honestly, I believe that the principles as they stand, they can help all of these. That's no question about it. But I wouldn't call them everything a management accounting. When we start to call everything a management accounting, then it's nothing anymore. So that's a paradox always. So again, I would kind of like to have, if we talk about, we have some kind of professional designation. There should be some content in it. If it's everything, it's nothing. So again, I would advise that if we want to develop this further, we should exclude something out of this. And for those we actually work on and what we do, we should be developing a little bit further. But again, I think overall this section on how these principles should be applied to practices is much more insightful than the performance management one. If you bear with me for a few minutes, I'll sort of cover a few of my sort of observations about this section of there is this table 2 and then all these practice areas. Some of the things, I mean, again, take this as a constructive critique, so how to improve, not as a sort of saying that, okay, I don't like what you try to do. Basically, I'm supporting this initiative, but then again, I'm having a little bit problems of seeing, okay, how, as they do stand today, help us. External reporting. It says that the board of directors are sort of management accounting provides external reporting for board of directors, or then I'm reading it somehow wrong. But for me, I'm sitting on the board of directors of a couple of organizations, and I consider myself not an external to the organization, but internal. I mean, I have to sign what we report out from the organization, but there's heaps of information that management accountants produce for me when I'm a member of the board. Then there's this financial strategy part. The definition column refers to more to business strategy, as I read it. But then if you look at the management accounting contribution, it refers to dividend policy, working capital management, optimal capital structure, and so forth. So again, I'll find a little bit mismatch here. And again, I think we should be more clear on what we mean. Investment appraisal is mentioned here, but it's also a separate section. You warn us not to produce repetition in our reporting and our communication, but then it seems to be at least some places here we sort of fall in the same trap. Communication includes forecasting performance. What I've sort of been talking a lot with the CFOs and business controllers in my country is the forward-looking indicators. I didn't find any sort of... I understand we try to produce forecast, but what I mean by forward-looking indicators, I might take an example of say, KONE elevators, a large global organization producing elevators, and what they use as a kind of a leading indicator for their business is order intake of architects. So again, they try to pick up what is the building or constructing activity, and they have formal methods of collecting data on how architects pick up jobs, and that sort of gives them an indication on how their business might actually evolve in it. And a lot of other type of examples that could be, if we want to talk about best practice, would be something that might be included in here. It says that the impact on value is analyzed by earnings per share, free cash flow, return on assets, market share, customer satisfaction. And no word about economic value added, no word about residual income. We are not talking about cost of capital in this place, or as a weighted average cost of capital as a benchmark. Is this a best practice? I have a really nice document. I mean, I don't know how many of you are aware of these documents some of the German firms produce. Mark was highlighting Volkswagen's practices, and Volkswagen have published their financial control policies, or there's a document, PDF document you can find in their websites. And it's based on economic value added, and they explain how they run the company, their different business, how they make decisions based on economic value added. And again, if I would think what is the best practice, I would say, okay, at least we have to discuss this. And so forth. Okay, investment appraisal, discount rate is average cost of capital plus systematic risk factor applied to future cash flows. When I was a kid and I was sitting in the business school, I was taught that one of the risks and mistakes we can make is that we actually try to assess risk both in an interest, so the discount rate and the cash flows. So don't try to make it many times, but make sure that you deal with both, either with the cash flows or discount rate. But when I'm reading this, somehow it suggests that we do it in both ways. Well, we talk about management and budgetary control. How about firms like Handelsbanken and all this beyond budgeting movement, where they don't do budgets? So is budgeting best practice? Would it be best practice for all companies? I mean, I don't know how many of you know the Handelsbanken case or a number of other sort of companies that basically run their operations with league tables. And when you have league tables, then of course you don't have to sort of stick with the predetermined targets. And again, what is the best practice in target setting? I wouldn't dare to say it sort of follows some kind of a given rule. And for some companies, one model fits, and for some other model, I guess. Price, discount, and product decisions. Do all firms need really similar type of tools? Again, I would suspect that a small restaurant, a construction company providing bids for each and single different projects, as opposed to some other hardware store, would have a little bit different pricing tools. And again, there's some notions that I couldn't really follow up with what this means. But those are just written up here for you to sort of check out that it makes sense. regulatory adherence and compliance. This is, by the way, last slide on this. Definitely under CFO, but is that part of the management accounting? Resource management, what are resource maps? Management accountants produce resource maps that highlight requirements, returns, and options. Again, I don't know what you mean by those resource maps, and if they are really best practice, then I have learned something new, but I would learn a little bit more, I guess. I tried to I set up the resource map on Google, and I didn't find anything meaningful. So, again, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. But again, what you write under this resource management comes very close to the transformation and cost transformation and management set. You're referring to the business case. And again, I would like to see much more sort of thinking and perhaps commentary on what's the role of management accountants in building business cases. That's basically what we try to teach our students nowadays. And the risk management. Again, I fully agree that the risk management is extremely important part of any business today. But is it something that belongs to management accounting function? I've been working with major banks and insurance companies, and for those, the risk management is a totally different ballgame. I mean, again, there's separate functions and a specialist which has a little bit different training than management accounting training to support the activities in risk management. And treasury and cash management, the corporate handling of all financial matters. And if you go back to this and then start to read the financial strategy, again, I find a quite heavy overlap here. So that would be something I would do to improve the principles document. All right. For the discussion part, I think, as I mentioned already, for me it seems there's a very heavy emphasis on decision making, only few references to management control. And I think both are essential, so if we want to develop these, why don't we sort of try to incorporate this management control part of the story. Some practices discussed are not traditionally seen as management accounting, as part of management accounting. Again, my advice would be stick with what's core of management accounting and leave much of the other stuff out. That would simplify it, and then on those what we left and work with, we could deal with a little bit more sort of in detail. If this to be the guide to best practice, I guess I've sort of highlighted a couple of things that could be still worked on and fixed. But I understand this is the work in progress, and again, so that's why I really hope you take my comments in a constructive spirit. And again, as I suggested already, the criteria for various level of competence would be really interesting to read and define and work on. Again, all four principles make sense, but they unfortunately appear kind of self-evident to me. But perhaps they are not self-evident for someone who's not trained, not been working here for so long. So again, I mean, it's a little bit unfair for me to come and with all my experience to comment on something that is perhaps not targeted to me. So again, it depends on who's the target audience, I guess. I guess that the really interesting issue and question is, could management accounting standards work better? And again, I think defining universal standards would be even more difficult task than agreeing on some very broad principles. At least there would be relatively few areas where we could say that there is a best practice. But again, if we would sort of take this forward, these standards at least could be a little bit more specific and perhaps more instrumental. But I would still argue that perhaps it's not wise to try to sort of create universal best practices, but try to sort of do some thinking on what are the contextual limitations of certain practices. Should they be voluntary or forced? My opinion is that for sure voluntary. This should be sort of guiding companies, but who would actually force these and look after? I'm not quite sure, but I know that the accounting standards and sort of in financial accounting side, we have a lot of sort of legislation sort of requiring us to do various things. But then again, here, I would still kind of leave it to organizations and allow them to report on these practices, like the Volkswagen does. So when they find it beneficial for them to stick with certain kind of a framework, certain kind of principles, if they find it beneficial to report, why not? Could the existence of principles-led research, I'm not quite sure about this one, that they would somehow help. But of course, once we accept that, okay, we have certain principles, and as we heard from Naomi, that companies have started to apply these, then my question, of course, is what it means. I mean, applying what? And if I have adopted these principles, how has it changed something? Has it been beneficial? Or what are the obstacles of applying those things? If they don't help, why? And so forth. So again, whatever we do here in kind of a standard setting or providing principles, of course, that creates opportunities for researchers if they want to understand what organizations do. But I guess the question could be wrong here. And I guess, should we ask, could academic research actually aid the development of these principles? And then again, this brings me back to one of my pet topics, is that, well, again, if we look at the academic accounting research, we always try to explain accounting choice, but perhaps we should be looking more that once the choice has been made, is it effective or not? And again, if you compare this to clinical research in medicine, for example, what these guys talk about is evidence-based medicine. And again, I think my view would be that, okay, once we have certain best practices, our job as an academic should be kind of trying to figure out what are those best practices, which one of them work and which don't, and then change those best practices. But unfortunately, very few of us engage that type of academic research. Again, how do the principles fare in relation to stated needs? I would say that if you look back, the designation requires criteria, and these principles can provide some kind of a framework for you to discuss and assess that. That's fine. That's fair. But then again, is it sort of elaborated enough, or are the requirements somehow demanding so that once you really nominate someone and say, okay, you have really deserved this designation, what do we actually know about this person? And again, I would sort of urge us to develop some kind of a more sort of a specific framework if we want to have that kind of a designation. Perhaps I'm less positive on the ability as they stand to inform best practice or provide the benchmarking. Of course, they would tell what to benchmark, but that should be obvious also without these principles. But they do. At least to my mind, they outline some of the fundamental values and qualities, and they improve our understanding of management accounting profession, at least for those who don't really are in this field. And again, I think they perhaps increase the recognition of crucial role of management accounting in organizations. So for at least some of the stated needs, we are able to answer with these, but then for some, I think there's some way to go still. So, to conclude, a personal view. If practitioners have developed this, who the heck am I to tell that they are not relevant or useful? So again, I might be a wrong guy to say something about this. I would say the only time will tell us. If you have developed and feel these are required and necessary and useful, then by all means, apply them, use them. And I fully agree and support the intentions why these were sort of developed. So in that sense, I'm not, although I'm critical as they stand today, I'm not critical against or towards the idea of what you aim for by developing this. Again, if the world becomes more complex, really, is it the principles that are the solution? And if they are the solutions, well, is it really something that as broad as they presented today, or should we take them in more detail? Repeated that comment quite many times, but I hope to sort of at least becomes clear. At worst, if you take again a big picture and we go back to the Magna Carta, I guess it's a kind of a thing where you think about the Western societies today, especially Europe and its competitiveness against, say, Eastern countries and developing countries, and my worry here is that we create bureaucracy and we create norms and we start to follow things that are somehow aiming for good and then not really adding value to our customers. I'm not sure about this, but still, there's some kind of worry that we tend to over-engineer our sort of practices, and that's at least something that I would be worried about. So my personal view then, a way forward, I guess, a question mark, would be that management accounting research community could support the development of best practice, whether you want to call them principles or standards or something else. So what I think is, what we need is some kind of a framework, what we think is the best practice. Whether you call them principles, standards, or something else, I don't care. But then again, the question then is how do we define what is best practice? Now, we have a lot of textbooks today, which we use in the teaching. Then my question is, are those textbooks the best practice? And again, many of those textbooks present things as their universal truths. And then again, I think our job as an academic could be to test the limits and contextual sort of boundaries of those universal truths. And then we could sort of move on to somehow develop a best practices which are a little bit more limited than a universal truth. So they could be industry size or many other types dependent. Of course, if we would, as researchers, would engage this kind of an activity, they would use us to use various type of research methods, including interventionist research like field experiments. I've seen a couple of quite nice recent examples of these field experiments, and as I understand, many organizations, when they start to renew or develop something, they do it by prototyping or they do it by piloting. So again, I would think that we have much more opportunities in to be engaged within the organizations to see what systems work and what not, and then bring it back. And so those of you know me, so finishing this presentation with the request of research serving practice should be as a no surprise, because at the end of the day, I think we should be able to tell what accounting practices and how use produce desired outcomes. And again, this is the same worry for both practitioners and accountants, as I understand, as an academic accountant. Thank you very much.
Hi, Dan Dartington, Health Innovation Network. One of the criticisms that you put forward and put forward earlier was that you have these set of principles and you read them and you say, there's nothing new here, I'm not learning anything, therefore questioning the value. Mm. But the value of principles is not that they're something you learn and they're new, it's in the application. Mm. And it's very easy in an ideal situation when you're calmly looking at a set of principles say, well, of course, this is completely self-evident. Mm. But if we look at personal mistakes we've made in our work or mistakes organizations have made, we can pretty much nail down it's because of not doing things that we knew to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's the value of principles. It's not that they're something that you... I didn't know to do that. It's the reminder that when things are really difficult, when your organization is under threat in some form, to keep doing these things and keep following these principles, because they're not a guarantee of success, but forgetting them, it's pretty much a guarantee of failure in my observation experience.
Thank you for your comment, and I fully agree with you. I mean, it's an extremely, extremely good point. I guess that my question then would be that, okay, because at least to me it seems that we know, because we know these, and then we still fail. We fail to follow them. So even though they are there, they are somewhere out there, would they still help? And this is kind of I'm not sort of saying that, okay, perhaps if they even help out some companies, some organizations to succeed instead of failing, that's good enough already. But then again, I understand your point that it doesn't probably need to have something new. But as I'm looking at them from an academic perspective, I would sort of say, okay, let's try to develop together something that is a little bit more instrumental and what we could call best practice. I understand these principles are best practice in a sense, but in a so broad level that, again, getting to the problems and then reviewing the principles and then fixing it, I'm again, a little bit sort of uneasy with that idea.
Yeah, hi. Alan Lowe from Aston Business School. I really enjoyed the presentation. I love it when people speak that fast. Just picking up a point on your final slide, something that troubles me about management accounting research, or what it is we're trying to do as management accounting researchers, is this idea about outcomes, desirable outcomes. So being the sort of researcher I am, I have no idea what a desirable outcome is. Mm. We tend to take this far too much for granted. It just strikes me that, you know, one of the things Naomi did spend a lot of time emphasizing was the fact that we actually need a change in what we are trying to achieve. I'm not expecting that to occur anytime soon, but this idea of contributing more to society, et cetera, et cetera. So on this, do you have a comment on the desirable outcomes? My view would be that practitioners are not the only people in the game here.
I'm not quite sure if I understood your question right, but basically what I've been sort of thinking this, I mean, whatever you try to provide some kind of a normative advice, you have to have some kind of, or assume some kind of a utility function. So there is some kind of a idea what you try to achieve, and that could be shareholder value, that could be environmental sort of stewardship or whatever. And then again, in a complex world, you actually have to satisfy multiple demands and multiple sort of requests, I guess. So, but then again, for me, thinking of this is in a sense something that when we talk about best practice, again, there could be a little bit best practice if your goals are one way or something else. So again, becoming with a set of universal rules that would apply any utility function, I don't believe that. So again, I think what we should be asking all the time is, okay, what is it that we try to achieve? What is it that we try to get at? And then think about what would be the best accounting practices and norms for that purpose. Of course, some of the principles might be general for all of this, but at least when we take it a step further.
Thank you, Temu. We're out of time, I'm
afraid. Thank you.
Okay, so this is the point where we separate you into groups. You will have a sheet, or you will have a senior sheet, that tells you which group you're in. There are six groups, two of which are in the Hong Kong Theatre, and you've got sort of four other groups on floors two and three. I would ask you to come back by 4:15, because we'll have presentations then. If you haven't been assigned to a group, then just join the group that is meeting here. We'll see you in half an hour. Actually, you could come in because you love the mic. Yeah, but maybe I'm hoping there'll be enough 2 minutes to just give you a flash. Because there's going to be pros and cons. Yeah, next to the competition.
I'm here.
Okay, so we'll need to make a start. So we have the facilitators from the six groups who are going to spend 3 minutes to tell us what the group's findings were on the challenges and opportunities of measuring and counting. We also, hopefully, will have enough time for Temu and Naomi to give us their last-minute reflections on what was said. So if I can start with Group 1, John.
Thank you very much, Anna. I'm John Arabafo, a lecturer at Royal Holloway, University of London. We met in Group 1, and of course, very quick succession. And on the good side, in terms of opportunities that we see in MA principles, we saw that it was a good thing as a template, as something that provides a notes and bolt, and is a codified integrative mechanism that we can all look forward to. In a sense, we see it as a not one size fits all. It's a guideline, a principle. We also see it as a relevance gain in the sense that the value in these principles lies in the eyes of whoever is the beneficiary or the beholder, as the case might be. And in that sense, we see it as benefiting more of the practitioners, such as CFOs and then FDs. And we see it as a good code in terms of enacting fairness and ethics, and that we see value of benefit there. We see it also as an MOT check, a kind of litmus test to assess the strengths and failures or weaknesses of organizational vitality. On the opportunity side, we see it as a processual or very dynamic framework that hopefully will evolve over time. Now, if we flip to the other side, which is the challenges for MA principles, we see it was quite contentious and quite quick. But we see problems or possible challenges with the extent to which it is non-mandatory. Who would enforce this? How, to what extent can we enforce these principles? So it becomes a challenge. And then how would the principles evolve over time? Again, that was something that we see as a possible challenge. And then there was issues raised about who and what are the targets of the principles and how would it be applied? Its application in terms of its wider context. And to some extent, well, this is maybe a dig against the CIMA, but it was seen as possibly an underlying signature to take dominance within this area of accounting, where CIMA could put a seal of approval to say, this is what we've done for in terms of the scheme of global accounting competition, so to speak. Then there was the issue about exclusivity of principles. To what extent could we say that, could management accountants, for that matter, claim exclusivity to these principles? Because some of these, again, we had a wide array of backgrounds, and some have engineering background, and they sort of saw project management skills being borrowed from these sort of principles. And again, we could follow on from financial accounting principles. How have we learned from financial accounting principles? And to what extent has financial accounting principles served accounting body and business generally? And lastly, possibly, we see management accounting role as the cherry on top of the cake, in the sense that if we do it right, it provides the competitive advantage. So to what extent, if all businesses and all practitioners, for that matter, follow this management accounting principles, are we not going to erode this idea of competitive advantage across board? And then that relates back to, I think, Peters and Waterman in 1986, when they did their framework about successful businesses and unsuccessful businesses. A couple of years down the line, most of the companies that they sort of stated as being successful had fallen over. So these are possible challenges. Nonetheless, I think the advantages or the opportunities maybe are strong. It's the first step of so-called first principles, codified principles. It's not like it's new, but it is a codified principles that integrate existing but disparate ideas from elsewhere. So hopefully, you see these challenges as a way to maybe make it better. So that is, in a sense, a quick summary of what Group 1 came up with. I hope I've saved the Group 1. Thank you.
Right, I'm going to be exploiting the 70% trust that you have in me. So, the overriding thing that we thought it was a great first attempt, so, our talk was around that. We thought it would be very valuable to some organisations, particularly public sector. In terms of people, we felt that it would provides an excellent self-checking document for members. And then the next level we went up to was that it would be very useful if you were running a finance department to show your management accountants what they should be doing, which maybe they're not doing. So we like that very much in terms of line management and training. We weren't so sure about it at organisation level. There was worries that if you try to sort of circulate it in an organisation level, I don't like to say this, Naomi, but they might not read it.
You haven't all read it, cover to cover?
The bin was mentioned several times. As far as challenges, there's some concern around the word global. Some people were much more comfortable with management accounting principles rather than global with all its connotations. A bit of a worry about a land grab going on, that we can do everything. Obviously we can, but maybe we shouldn't shout that quite so much. We were very keen on the being involved and not owning everything. So where do we go from here? Well, the conclusion was, and I'm going to be 3 minutes, that we would like to see some evidence. It's early days yet. And a bit worried about one size fits all, but a series of evidence-based case studies would, I think, flesh them out and be really helpful. Is that okay, team? Yeah? Haven't lied too much? Thank you.
Hello, I'm Kim Langfield-Smith from Monash University. In our group, we had a mix of people from academia and in practice, and also people from many different countries, which was interesting because we had quite a lot of agreement among those different people in the group. On the opportunity side, we saw a positive with the framework that it would provide a single model that people could consult to develop good practice. It was all in a single place, so that was a positive. Being slightly cynical, we thought it was a good exercise in profile building, promoting of management accountants, and it would certainly help delineate or even perhaps legitimate the professional of management accountants. So that could be looked on as an opportunity. Now, on the challenges side, very similar to Lynn's group, we had quite a lot of argument over does management accounting really exist? Not just the academics, the practitioners. And someone suggested this is a new argument. And I said, well, no, we were talking about this 20 years ago. So or even longer. So we were concerned perhaps that we've got a set of principles now for management accounting when we're not quite sure what it is or whether it does exist, and if these people are in organisations, they're often called other things, but we couldn't decide what those other things were. It's a something there. There's certainly something there with a whole lot of stuff that they do, but we don't know what they're called. And in many cases, we could take the framework and substitute a variety of different organisational titles and still find it very useful, whether it's an information management professional or a very good practice manager would also fit very nicely to many of those basic principles. We also questioned the word global. That made some of our people feel quite uncomfortable, but I read the word global to mean that it was applicable in many different contexts. But the question that some people had was, can the framework apply in all contexts, particularly in developing nations or perhaps in SMEs? There was some uncertainty there whether it was whether it was as generic and applicable across different types of organisations and countries. And I think that was probably most of what we talked about, group. Yes? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Gillian Lees from SEMA, and we had quite an interesting chat in our group. I'm just going to make a few key points that came up in our discussion. We started from the premise that the principles were a useful way of stepping back and taking stock, but the challenge for a practitioner was how do you actually apply them, and time being a key issue, just to be able to think about all of that. But they were useful, for example, if you were having to design a new system or a process, that would be a time when you were standing back and taking stock. We also talked about how it was actually good to have something written down, and how the principles are a bedrock on which practices can be built. So we had a bit of conversation around should the principles be varied by sector, but we kind of, I'm not sure if we had agreement on that, but it was more like it's the practices which may vary. There were some concerns that the principles kind of fell between a few stools and left people cold, and also the concern that we were making everything management accounting, so that view was expressed. We talked about whether to apply the principles in terms of whether they should operate on a comply or explain basis. We also felt the need to perhaps be more on control, which was in the earlier presentation, because the management accounting information is used not just for decision making but for control. In terms of opportunities, we talked about multinationals who have got all sorts of things all over the place, and might find it very challenging to have common systems, so the principles were quite useful for organisations in that scenario. We then talked about the role of the principles in terms of elevating the profession, the management accounting profession globally, but the accountancy profession as a whole. And we felt that maybe this was part of a contribution to restore trust in business as a whole. So it was part of that much bigger jigsaw. And finally, we talked about, it was a point just made at the end, which was there was also an opportunity for educators maybe to introduce the next generation to the principles. So that was largely it. We also had quite an interesting conversation earlier in the piece about if you'd been a management accountant and then you became a chief executive, which hat did you have on? And where were the principles being used? And I think we came to the point that it's actually the management accountant using the principles to advise and recommend and provide that information to the decision maker. So we had quite an interesting conversation about that. So it's quite a broad range conversation, but hopefully lots of interesting takeaways from that. So thank you very much.
Thanks, and I tried to wriggle out of this on the basis that I'm very biased, but I think I'll try and... Michael had trust in me to be objective. So I think one of the things that the big challenge is hitting that sweet spot between meaningless, high-level sort of truisms and something that's got some meat on it in terms of practices. And the document tries to do both. And I think, you know, the discussion was that how do you hit that sweet spot is really, really difficult. So I have every sympathy with that. And we were talking about, should it be principles? Should it be value? Should it be standards? Should it be best practices? Should it be techniques? And, you know, it's almost trying to achieve all of those, plus the ethics and the people side. So it's trying to achieve a hell of a lot. So that's, you know, it's a big, big challenge. And we were given the example of where, you know, best practice has been useful in terms of health and safety, in terms of office space. So, you know, maybe there is something in it. One of the things that came up that would be helpful and a challenge is how do we deconstruct some of the terms in the principles? And I thought when Naomi presented on insight and deconstructed what insight is, because that's an easy throwaway term, I thought it was really good. But I don't think that deconstruction features in the principles. So I think that may be a missed opportunity, so that deconstruction. And the other thing that was mentioned was, who are these for? And Naomi said, they're not for you. They're not for people who understand management accounting. They're to manage the demand side. So line management and CEOs and so on, who should be applying these. And I guess my challenge is, if that's the audience, you are never going to attract them if you call them management accounting principles. So I'd be really interested to know, in terms of the consultation, how many people you consulted were management accountants, what proportion were management accountants and SEMA members, what proportion were academics, and what proportion were CEOs, marketeers, credit analysts, and so on and so forth. So those were our three. Well, those are my interpretation of 3 points. But Naomi has the platform to correct me.
Wim van der Steed from the LSC. Very interesting discussion in our group. Coming last, of course, there are some points that already have been made. So let me try to be hitting the key points. One was, who is this for? Is it the individual trying to understand what the job is about at the task level? Is it the organization who wants to set a tone for management accountants or related jobs in their organization? Is it for SEMA in a profiling role, as SEMA is distinct from other accreditation bodies? Or is it actually beyond SEMA, sort of a profiling, I think is what Lynn mentioned, for the profession? And we didn't really come out of that what it was, and actually my personal view is that it can be all, and it probably should be all. In terms of profiling for the profession, of course it's associated with SEMA, but it's also helpful for organizations and for individuals in these positions. So I think we spent quite a bit of time on that. In terms of Kim's point, the titles, we have that too. I have yet to meet someone who gave me a business card that says on it management accountant. These days it says things like a data scientist, for example, because big data is big. In that sense, the practitioners, particularly in our group, felt that the principles were actually bringing consistency to something that to which there is no consistency if you look at the titles that people have on their business cards or their job definitions. So at the end of the day, whether you're called a data scientist or a budget analyst or the favorite term this morning, financial analysis or analyst, the group thought, with some, I think, some support, that consistency of the principles was a feature, so an opportunity. Another important point is, and as the sweet spot that I wouldn't have come up with that word, but that Rick came up with, when is too broad, not specific enough, and at what point does it become too specific and narrow, that you start having rules. And actually, we've seen this in financial accounting as well, where international financial standards, even though they're called standards, would be rather seen as principle-based, whereas in the US it's rule-based, and then you quickly run into tens of thousands of pages because every word leads to a different interpretation that then needs to clarify it and so on and so forth. And probably that's going to be the difficulty, Naomi. And I believe that the practitioners in our group particularly had more sympathy on the principle side than veering towards the rules side. They saw a tremendous benefit in it actually being broad as opposed to the next step in your development, trying to make it apply. Because then it's, oh, well, we're in a multinational, we're in the oil, we're manufacturing service, I'm running a church, a charity, a public. And so you could quickly see this becoming the 16,000 U.S. tax code, a 16,000-page U.S. tax code. And that, I think, would betray, I think, the purpose for which you've started on this project. And I think the practitioners in our group are very sympathetic to keeping it rather broad. Which takes me to my last substantive point. They actually saw it as very valuable for, and this comes back to Mark's presentation of this morning, for actually cross-functional communication. The practitioners, to my surprise, seem to actually run into quite some people in their organizations who don't have a good sense of what a finance professional or a management accountant or a controller does. And actually, for one of many different purposes, they thought that actually shoving that under their nose might be a good start for having them understand what finance professionals do. Then obviously it's also helpful, they thought, for training purposes, sort of that bedrock, I think, that Jillian talked about. So the key challenges, I think, to keep it closer to principles, then let it get into a rule book. But that is the inherent difficulty of the whole exercise, and I'm sure you're very aware of that. But the practitioners in our group found it tremendously beneficial and helpful. Okay?
If I can invite in either order, I suppose.
Ladies first.
Okay, all right. So can you give 2 or 3 minutes?
Sure, stand up. Yeah. Well, really just an enormous thank you, A, for the great privilege that it is to have hived these wonderful minds here today. So thank you very much to Michael and Al for the invitation and to everybody for participating in this debate. And I think what I've really heard is a lot of the contradictions. On the one hand, land grab, management accountants trying to be everything to everyone, but then Wim saying to us, I haven't actually met anyone with the job title management accountant. Sometimes they're financial analysts, sometimes they're data scientists, sometimes they're financial accountants or whatever it is. So, you know, therein lies one contradiction. And of course, all of the professional bodies' syllabi are very, very broad, and there's nothing listed in the second half of the document in those different practice areas which isn't taught in the CEMA syllabus. Okay, so all qualified management accountants should be perfectly capable of doing any one of those things. Whether or not you'd argue that they actually do them in real life or not is another matter. Then there's this contradiction between, oh, these should be high-level principles, and there's people saying, oh, but this is all theory, and where's the application? Show me the case study. Show me this working in practice. So I think that's my big takeaway from this. You know, you can please all of the people some of the time, some of the people all the time, and you definitely cannot please all of the people all the time. That is absolutely the case with these principles. But I hope that they have at least elicited some good thought processes. I think we're all in agreement that there hasn't been a framework to bring what we all disagree on the definition of management accountant being. I look forward to this evolving, and perhaps I can come back at a future conference and share some case studies of how people have either applied this at this very principles-based or even down into a much more sort of nitty-gritty diagnostic kind of level. So thank you all ever so much. Thank you.
It's always nice to have the last word. I was quite pleased to really hear from practitioners that they find this really useful and usable. And that's, again, it's once sort of you create something and you find it has values, then again, I'll sort of perhaps have to take some of my words back and say, yeah, if that's actually helping you to sort of assess, do self-checks, if that helps you to sort of summarize and structure what we do and how do we think our profession, then it's all fine. But I guess my question, and I sort of basically understand that we can have these sort of very broad principles in that sense, but my question, I guess, I'm worried is that, is there any way of actually producing what we might call a best practice in management accounting? And that's, again, it's somehow, I was talking in my speech about this medical research. We have an engineering research. I'm part of the engineering school nowadays, like Mark. And I still get a kind of a question, is why on Earth we don't have any kind of a tradition of trying to develop best practice? I know that we have sort of kind of agony against prescription, but still this kind of a evidence-based development of our practice, that would be something I would call for. And again, so for me, again, this seems to be that there's some good work done and there is still some work to be done, whether in forms of principles or as an academic community trying to develop and sort of help our companies to succeed. Okay, thanks.
Naomi and Temu. So we now are proceeding to the last part of the formal conference proceedings. We have the inimitable Mike Romich, whom I will not introduce because everybody knows him.
Yeah, you've seen enough of me, so I apologise. Al puts it that, you know, you've been around for a very long while, therefore you must have some wisdom to finish off the day. I'm not entirely convinced that's true at all, and in fact I know it's not, because I know that LSE will charge groups like this for their room, the rooms they use, unless they have an LSE speaker. Al didn't tell me that, but, you know. So that explains why I'm here. Timo sort of said he's got the last word, but he hasn't. I've got it. And the last word is very simple. Clearly, both the SEMA principles and the ICAEW approach are fairly new things and have clearly got to be developed and so on, and we all know that. What I like, and this is coming back from a very old very long experience, what I like is, as far as I can see, this is almost really the first time either institute has put any resources of their own into management accounting and trying to develop management accounting. Now, there's bits here and there, but this is a solid push by, I think, both organisations to actually do something for management accounting. I mean, if you look back, and perhaps you take a very sceptical view of accounting institutes who actually quite like you to take their exams and give them money for the rest of your life. And, you know, I really do think there is a change. The institutes actually want to try and do something for management accounting. They may do grave harm for all I know, but they may well do great good. So I welcome the fact that proper resources are being put into these things. Now, that's not what I'm here to justify my existence here, because we've got to pay for this room, so I've got to say something. Right. What I thought might be useful would be to say something about what's happened to practice over the years and how much academic stuff, as it were, has been taken on board. And this is just a diagram that shows some of this. And all those things there are well known by everybody. And one question, these are really the foundations of much of management accounting. One of the interesting questions is that most of those are throughout practice now, and most of those have actually sort of stopped really being subject to research. I haven't seen research articles in standard costing, for example, for a very long while. It may be it's now perfect, but I doubt that. Budgetary control, well, a major contribution, it wasn't really academic research, was to actually suggest it also ought to be stopped. Yeah. So we haven't really, as I say, research has tended to abandon these things. It may well be they should come back because they are still mainstream things. This is a more modern version of the same sort of thing. You can select some more things, but basically activity-based costing, balanced scorecard, re-engineering, value-added management, big data, the more recent ones, big data, and accounting for web products. They are some of the new things that have been wandering about. Now, basically, the ones I showed you before, very few of those were ever products of academic research. The ones you can say were is DCF in the previous diagram. DCF, the rest actually weren't. Improved costing was actually engineers. Most of these, again, really not much to do with accounting. Activity-based costing was to do with practice. It was certainly smoothed and made beautiful by academics. But, you know, it came from practice. Balanced scorecard, again, came from practice. Again, smoothed very beautifully and related to strategy and goodness knows what. Value-added management is a bit of both. It started in practice a long, 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 long while ago, but has been moved on by quite a lot of academic research work. Big data research, I'm not sure. In accounting, I'm not sure. I haven't seen much. Clearly, we're going to have to get involved in that. And I suggest that at the moment, anyway, the practice is well ahead of research in this area. Accounting for web products is something I'm very interested in, and luckily hardly anybody else is. It produces really major problems, because basically what we're really good at as management accountants is variable costs, you know, nice linear costs with activity and so on. Well, and revenue that goes with each product you sell, all those things don't apply to web products. There's hardly any variable cost in a web product, Google or whatever. There's hardly any marginal cost, variable cost. The people who actually pay for Google and so on are not the consumers. Okay, so it's all different. And of course, the other thing is, although there's no variable cost, there's an enormous amount of overhead cost. You know, the development of Google and so on is enormously costly. European organisation is now saying, isn't it, we're so enormously costly, they've been a monopoly and are now have been taking money out of people. Who knows, taking money out of consumers, who knows. But that's an area which really needs to be looked at. And I have a horrible feeling, well, I'm not so sure. With accounting for web products, I'm not sure industry is very much ahead of anybody. And because nobody's, in my view, doing very much. What I do know is the standard accounting model just doesn't work. And that's worth thinking about. You can put one or two other things in there if you like. I wonder how many of them, though, would actually be research-generated rather than practice-generated. It's interesting. Of course, you can say, and quite rightly I think a lot of people would say, that management game research doesn't have much to do necessarily with producing things for practice. What it has to do with is trying to understand management accounting. I think I agree with that in many ways. On the other hand, it does seem surprising that our understanding of management accounting hasn't added very much to what seems to be the major approaches to accounting in practice. Al said I ought to be controversial, otherwise you'll all go to sleep, or we'll try and go to the buffet early, so I'm being controversial. Remember, this is the time of politics, and anybody making a speech doesn't necessarily believe what they say. If you look at both the dates on here and in the previous diagram, the early date is when it sort of started. So, for example, improved costings started round about 1914, round about that time, and finished quite quickly. But if you look at most of the other things, it takes 10 to 20 years for these things to become established, if not longer. If you look at the more modern things, clearly they're still being established, they take quite a long while as well. It's actually very, very difficult to get management accounting stuff put into practice. Why that is, I don't know. Because many industries, of course, that's the one thing you do. You try and find an innovation that nobody else has and use it. And that's what pushes the innovations forward quickly. But for some reason, in management accounting, it seems to take a very long while. It may be something to do with wanting to be sure that the ideas are worthwhile and so on. I'll leave that to you to think about. I haven't, in my second diagram, I haven't put in strategic management accounting. That's because the literature, I think, regards it as unsettled. At least Kim Langford Smith does. Where is she? Oh, there you are. Well, she doesn't regard it as unsettled. She regards it as possibly not working at all. I believe, however, accountants need to be outward looking, both in decision making and control. That's where the competitors are, that's where the customers are. It's interesting that the argument is not dissimilar to what's been said this afternoon. The argument is that there are too many things in strategic management accounting. And, you know, the definitions are different in different places and so on. Not very dissimilar to much of what has been said this afternoon about the various innovations suggested by the two accounting bodies. Now I'm going to lose some friends. Performance measurement and management and control systems and contingency theory, therefore, have a very large literature. Our understanding of that has gone up enormously over the years. As researchers, we understand much, much better now than we did. Though we still have some difficulty in what we mean by the advantages or disadvantages of, say, contingency theory. But looking at practice, I'm worried. There doesn't seem to me to at least have been a detailed impact on practice. It's true that general ideas have been accepted. So, for example, people now try to measure effort properly, which they didn't used to before. Similarly, the view is if you ask managers via reward functions to take on extra risk, then they should be compensated in some way or other. Those sort of generalities, I think, are part of the general industrial commercial discussions. But the detailed understanding we have of, say, performance measurement is much greater than that. But I don't think it's really pushed into practice. It doesn't qualify for one of my blue squares. I don't know why that is. But as I say, Al said I have to be controversial, so I thought I'd say that. Of course, I may not mean it, you know. It depends which party I'm supporting at the moment. Yeah, just to summarise, major lessons of history is that major and widely accepted, and that's what I'm talking about, accounting innovations are relatively rare. Research hasn't been very interested in accepting innovations. I don't believe they are perfect by any means. I think we should look at those again. The dispersion of major innovations is very slow. Of course, what's missing from my slides is that a very large number of innovations never make it. A very large number. The one I remember is linear programming. When I was a student, you were taught linear programming. From all I know, you still are taught linear programming. If you are, it will now be called strategic linear programming. But, you know, basically, in practice, apart from, the industries where it's clearly technologically sensible to use it, it's disappeared, which is a great shame because it did an awful lot of telling us about what were real economic costs. My view is that most important innovations in the past have already originated in practice. I hope that's not going to be true in the future, or less true in the future. Things I just added, big data and accounting for the web products, are due to changes in the environment. I just listed them here. There's an enormous number of changes in the environment. They change the economy. Therefore, to a degree, they ought to change accounting. That's what researchers should be doing. That's what some practitioners at least, should be worrying about. I'm not entirely convinced that that's what's happening. So, you know, as I said, I think earlier, we're not going to do that. As I said earlier, every time I hear talk about accounting, they're always gloomy. And I said that earlier. I'm sorry if my talk here is a little bit gloomy. It's not meant to be. There are vast opportunities, for example, with these changes, for both research and improvements in practice. If you can get some of these things right in practice, you're going to make a lot of money. Because one of the problems with accounting, I think, is that nobody believes it really does have corporate give major corporate advantage. I think it probably does, but we haven't been good enough yet to explain how. So that's really the justification for this room being free. I hope you've enjoyed today. I certainly think, apart from organising, the breakout groups, I think, were very interesting. They were instead of a senior financial manager or chairman of a company supposedly telling you about how they're wonderful at doing these things. So it might be interesting if people have got a view on the breakout groups, you know, are they a good idea or not? We would be very interested in hearing. Now, the Management Engineering Research Group has a sister organisation which is run by Aston Business School, and in the back of your pack there is a call for papers and also gives you the conference dates. It's fair to say that the focus is a little bit more on academic areas, so you do get academic papers read. So it is slightly different, but there are two sister groups, and you know, you should look, if you've enjoyed this, you might well enjoy that. When I say enjoy, I mean gain something, take away, you know, and so on. The other thing I need to say is that the buffet starts at 6:30, and they do not want you there before. So can you walk slowly to the old building where you were for lunch? This time you're going to the 5th floor, which is the senior common room. And I look forward to seeing you there. Please make sure you take all your variables. Values with you. Valuables with you. Thank you very much indeed. Bye-bye. What would I do without you? Thank you.